The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of Salem Media of Hawaii.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow Today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow Today.
Aloha, I'm Braden DeVos, and I'm back. Please support the homeless children. They're in danger. If you have any extra clothes or food, please give it to them. Now you're on with Jeff, the solar guy.
Literally, children living in a street with no running water and no bathrooms. Does that get through your mind?
No running water, no toilet for a child. Conceivably, we should be checking them into the Humane Society where they would receive at least that.
Oh, children, living in the streets. It's in my blood. It's in my blood. Living in the streets. The strongest metal. The strongest steel. Are they Superman?
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, on this Tuesday, September 9th, and today we are discussing Hawaii sea turtles. We have a jam-packed show talking with Hawaii's leading scientists and conservationists working with our green friends. So without further ado, let's share a little bit about the exciting research and program surrounding all things turtles. To begin with, we have Sean Murakawa, biological scientific technician for NOAA's Protected Species Division, calling into the show. Sean, are you there?
Hi, Cardi. I'm here.
Thanks for calling in, Sean.
Sure.
So tell me, how did you get interested in sea turtles?
Well, I always loved animals like every other kid, right, wanting to be a veterinarian. But also being born and raised in Oahu, I've always been fascinated by seeing the sea turtles swimming in the ocean. And after I graduated from the University of Hawaii, I was actually lucky enough to see a job announcement from NOAA working with sea turtles. And I've been actually very lucky that I've been at this job ever since.
And so you researched specifically the growth rates in turtles. Can you tell us a little bit about how you do this and what you look at?
Sure. It sounds kind of nerdy, I'm just going to warn you. But basically, there's two ways that we kind of measure the growth rate. The easiest way is actually to capture, and the fun way also, is to actually capture the animals, measure them, we release them, and we hope we can recapture them a year later. And by doing that, we can take their previous length and then compare it to their current length. Of course, just by subtracting and then calculating the time that has elapsed, we can then calculate the annual growth rate. Unfortunately, it's not always easy to do that. Turtles are, you know, they tend to stay in the same areas, but we don't always see the same turtles when we go out there. So sometimes, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because we have to use their bone, and when we get their bone, they have to be, unfortunately, dead. So a lot of times we collect samples from these dead stranded sea turtles that we do recover. And what we are able to use is the humeri, or the long arm bone. And that's the bone that is used to actually study growth rate. And basically, just a quick overview is I actually have to take a cross-section of the humerus, and I'm able to view growth rings, or similar to like tree rings and trees, like how they count the age of trees. That's what I end up doing.
Wow. Are the turtles easy to capture when you do look at their growth in the wild?
They're kind of like humans, we say. Every turtle is different, like every other animal, like your dog and your cat. So some can be slow-moving in water, some can be pretty fast. And in other areas, they're actually pretty tame. Turtles are used to their protection, so some of them will actually come ashore and just bask for sunbathing, like on the big islands. You're able to even approach it just on land, grab them safely, and then you know bring them back to shore so that we can measure them up and tag them and do what we have to do, and then release them. So it just depends on the turtle.
It sounds pretty fun, actually. So what kind of growth rates or trends do you see in the growth rates? Are they slow growing by gender or by location, or is it pretty much random selection when you look at the turtle growth rates?
It's a good question. I'm actually fairly new to this research. I just did it for my master's, which is only about 2 years ago. So I'm still trying to get back into it with work. But wasn't able to look at all differences, and I'm very interested to do that. So my next thing is to look at, you know, differences in locations or even health status. As you know, some of them are sick with tumors. So I'm really interested to see what the difference is with the sick versus the healthy turtles. But I was able to look at some of the gender differences. I was able to study about 100 turtles, so that means 100 bones. So preliminarily, I'll just say that I haven't published my data just yet, but my research shows that there is a potential in differences in the males and the females, and that the males actually show this growth spurt when they're younger, which is right before puberty hits or sexual maturity, whereas in the females, it seems like there's this big growth spurt right before they hit adulthood. It's right, we don't know what the difference is. And like I said, it could be, you know, maybe I'm just looking at specific locations, and unfortunately, my samples were from stranded sea turtles, so that could have been a factor as well. But the work is pretty similar to what was found in Australia for the males. Haven't seen anything very similar to the females is what I found. And I'm hoping to, as you mentioned, with locations in Hawaii, as everybody pretty much knows, the population of green sea turtles is growing. So what we're also finding is that we're seeing slower growth rates with the turtles that we do recapture, and that could be probably due to maybe the grease and foraging fee that's out there for them because there's so much of them. So we've seen, like I said, a slow decrease in growth rate, and I'm interested to see in the different foraging locations, like we're seeing research is done in Koloko on the Big Island, that there seems to be a lot of slow growth rates there and less food available for turtles. So I want to see what, you know, comparative to, say, Oahu or Maui or, you know, Kauai, any other island. And for that matter, even Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, if I'm able to get samples from there too.
Yeah, that would be really fascinating to see. How do you tell the difference between the males and the females?
Unfortunately, you can only do that when they're near adults or, you know, adult, because the difference is in seeing the length of the tail. Very similar to, or it's the same thing in freshwater turtles. If the tail is long, it's a male. If it's short and barely passes their shell, then it's a female. But other than that, you can't really tell.
And so you said you're very interested in looking at the differences between the Hawaiian Islands, the main Hawaiian Islands, and the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Are you comparing any of the Hawaii growth rates with other regions in the Pacific or elsewhere in the world?
I haven't done that yet. Like I said, I'm fairly new to this, but I've worked with other people, like in Beaufort. There's actually, NOAA Fisheries has a national sea turtle aging lab, and they do, you know, their turtles up there, and people send it to them. They also have different species as well. Here in Hawaii, the most common, as we know, is the green. Then we have the very endangered hawksbill. Whereas on, you know, their side of the world, or America, they have, like, tenth ridley, which we don't have. We have all the ridleys, but not as common. And then there's also leatherback people share. So I haven't done that yet, but that's my next step as well. I kind of want to collaborate with them, too.
Now, I know you're focusing on growth, but can you tell me a little bit about the population status? And we know it's growing, but why it's growing over the last couple years?
Sure. It's actually been a while. It's been since 1978 that they've been protected under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. And like I've mentioned, you know, it's been great for green sea turtles because their numbers have just grown astronomically. A study done in 2007 by Chidi Kambalaj estimated that the population before the stock actually declined in the 70s was about 320,000. But then based upon current nesting numbers, and we can only base population on nesting numbers because those are the turtles we can actually count, they're saying about 61,000 greens in coastal waters and, you know, slowly increasing. But unfortunately, the sad part of this is, although, you know, all turtles have been protected, the hawksbills are really critically endangered, and there's very actually few left in the wild. We've only been able to see maybe a handful, maybe to 20 max a year nesting in the main Hawaiian Islands total. So that's one species you really need to focus on and see, you know, what's going on with them.
Wow. And is it true that the green sea turtles here in Hawaii, they nest in the same locations, or are you seeing nesting happening in different areas?
It is true. For sea turtles, they have some species with an innate ability to return to the same nesting beach. And if for some reason that beach is no longer there or developed or whatever, they do tend to return to that same area. Everybody says that, you know, there must be something in their brain or magnet or something that's making them focus on this one particular beach. But there's even studies done, although there is this small amount of magnetite in their head, you know, people think that's part of their compass, their biological compass. Researchers have even put magnets on their head and on their shells to see if that would kind of distract them or throw them off course. And for some reason, nope, the turtles head to that same place. So for us, as a researcher, is that makes it kind of nice because we can go back to those same locations and actually see these same nesters. And we can study, you know, these known nesters. We can see how old they live, you know, how many nests they did lay and things like that. And the good thing is we see numbers increase every year, or every, I would say, 2 or 3 years, because turtles nest every 2 or 3 years. And my coworker, who just went up to the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands to complete the nesting season, told us that there was a great number. It was 811 nesters, which is a record high of all time. And with modeling, because, you know, there's always some numbers you have to throw in there because you might lose a nester, they're going to estimate maybe over 850 nesters for this past year, which is just awesome.
Wow, that number is astronomical. That's fantastic.
That's great. And the other good thing is we have also heard records of turtles nesting in the main Hawaiian Islands as well. So we know they're starting to slowly come back to the main Hawaiian Islands. Not as great as before, but at least we know that they're increasing as well.
That's amazing information. Thank you so much, Sean, for your hard work and for giving us a call today to talk about turtles. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we continue, we're going to talk about sea turtles and conservation with Kyle Van Houten. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Leakmaster Roofing, Kamayama Solar, Grand Solar, BenQ Solar, and the University of Hawaii Research Corporation.
760 KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Several new accidents in town at Dolan University, in Pearl City on Ho'olalea at Ho'omalu, and we got an accident on the H1 westbound out at Manager's Drive. The slowdown's going west, typical. The H1 slows at the airport exit. The Moana Lua slows at Middle Street. To the windward side, had a stall on the Pali Highway at the tunnels. It's slower than usual from the tunnels down to Castle Junction.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. The tax year, the end of the year, are quickly approaching. The end of December, all PV systems have to be installed, all solar water systems, all solar pool pumps, you name it, all solar products must be installed before the end of the year in order to take a tax credit for 2014. Hawaiian Electric has slowed down the process, so I would encourage anyone who is interested, whether they plan to go through it or not in the end, at least get in the queue. Get in line with Hawaiian Electric by simply giving me a call, your solar guy Jeff, at 554-7200. There's no charge, there's no commitment. We send that in and we wait to see for Hawaiian Electric. Now, there may be a time that comes when there will be no ability to do so. So I encourage any and all of you who are considering photovoltaics, give me a call at 554-7200. And let's just send your paperwork in and get you approved. No matter how long it might take, at least you're in line with Hawaiian Electric. It's free. There's no charge. There's no commitment to any particular solar company. I'll be happy to help you with it. That's my job. So just give your solar guy, Jeff Davis, a call. 554-7200. Aloha.
Babies cry. Children squeal. Riding round the tricycles or the three.
Kanilea, family-owned, locally manufactured in Kaneohe. Kanilea Ukulele is our local one-stop shop for all grades and styles of ukulele and guitar lele.
Aloha, it's Jeff. I'm so happy and proud to be using Kanilea's instruments. Now, the guitar lele, the koa instrument that they have made for me, is something I cherish and I'll keep for the rest of my life. I mean, honestly, it beats my Martin, it beats my Taylor, it beats my Ovation. I love the Kanilea sound. So please give them a call and check out their showroom in Kaneohe. Aloha.
Located in Kaneohe Industrial Park at 216 Kahuhipa Street. Just call 234-2868.
Aloha. Hawaii's Tomorrow and Jeff Davis are looking for motivated people. Are you a writer? The Solar Guy could use some comedy. Would you like to intern? You know he's got room, so give Jeff a call. Jeff Davis at 554-7200. 554-7200.
Aloha nohoi kako and ho mai kai nohoi praise to Jeff Davis.
You're terrible at this.
I'm terrible.
I love you, Ruby. Aloha.
My name is Braden Navas, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, Solar Guy.
Mm-hmm.
listening, then listen closely. Listen with your heart and hear the whole beat. I just want to show you, like someone showed me, that we can make a change, moving on your own feet. It's no secret the struggle is real, and how many of us struggle with bills? Some live in places a roof can't cover, but why should the children have to suffer? It's not a lifestyle they should be living. When will we stand up and make a decision to see less homeless and new buildings?
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are talking about Hawaii sea turtles. With us now is Kyle Van Houten, program lead and research ecologist for NOAA's Protected Species Division. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for calling in. Now, Kyle, you've done some really interesting turtle research as well, but you're using a different approach. Instead of looking at growth rates, you're looking at restaurant menus. How can you learn anything about a population from a restaurant menu?
Well, we didn't set out to actually look at a restaurant menu. So it was something we came upon kind of opportunistically. It's part of our larger research program on historical ecology that we're looking at with sea turtles. And I'll get to what that is in a minute. But we basically just went to support some long-term data we had here on the commercial fishery for turtles that existed in Hawaii from the 40s through the 1970s. And we actually just, I knew that they serve turtle in the restaurants here, like they did in the mainland in various places. And I just wanted to get a picture of one of these old menus, because I had seen some of the covers and they looked kind of pretty and artistic, but I also just wanted to get a picture of turtle on the menu to put in this article that we were doing on the turtle fishery, just to kind of remind people in their consciousness that turtle was actually, it wasn't just always ecotourism and it wasn't just for conservation. It actually was, you know, consumed commercially fairly widespread, and just kind of wanted to have that picture. But when we found, I kind of was surprised when we went back to find, I mean, you can't just find these menus everywhere, right? It's not like there's a Dewey Decimal System for restaurant menus. So when we found like a little pocket with a collection with a private collector, we found like 30 menus and there was no turtle in any of the menus. And then we found another private collector that had like 20 more and there was no turtle on the menu. Then we found about 40 more and then 20 more here. And we were up at 100 menus and we only had one with turtle on it. And then we said, maybe this is the story. And then at the same time, when we were looking at these menus, we said, there's all these things on here from the ocean that they're serving in Hawaii back to the 1800s, which was when some of our earliest menus were. And they said, well, if I'm going to go through all these menus and do all this work to write down what's on there, then there might be a larger sort of analysis that we could do.
Fascinating. So what were the final results from that menu study?
Well, we ended up getting about 500 menus, and we kind of had to stop it there because it kind of was... I was getting people were sending me books and menus from the mainland, from California. They heard some work that we were doing. And, you know, I've found quite a bit on eBay and Craigslist and things that people might, you know, normally go to find cool old Hawaiian artifacts. But what we had found was that, you know, a lot of the nearshore reef species were very popular. And, you know, things like kumu and veke, you know, goatfish, very popular still today that people go spearfishing for. But these are very common in the restaurant menus. A lot of reef fish, nearshore fish were very common in menus, but they basically plummeted. By the time Hawaii became a state, they were on less than 10%, 5% of the menus. But before World War II, they were on 100% of the menus. And so these local nearshore, you know, native and some endemic Hawaiian fish were replaced by offshore species, large predatory species that, you know, that became with a large offshore fishing fleet. So we saw a shift, kind of a massive shift from local nearshore species to offshore large-bodied swordfish, ahi tuna, mahi-mahi. These were on less than 10% of the menus in before World War II, but around 1975, they were on all the menus. So there's this massive shift that sort of evidenced in the restaurant menus.
So interesting. What a unique way of looking at historical records. And you know, the research that you do is not just concerned around these historical menus. You do a lot of work in real time as well. Can you tell me a little bit about the concerns you have surrounding turtle populations and fisheries, or the types of research that you're doing with the current turtle populations?
Well, we have we kind of take a creative approach. We want to understand, you know, all that we can from the data that we collect. And in the federal government, we have a lot of research programs, and we're doing a lot of things through strandings programs, which is what my colleague Sean Murakawa talked to you a little bit about, some work that she's doing. We have in-water capture programs. We work with fisheries, and then we do a lot of modeling and work with climate and satellite data. And what we're trying to, you know, really get at is how can we, and I know a lot of turtle populations are in very remote areas that are hard to access. So sometimes we have to go through proxies or, you know, data substitutes to understand what's going on. So what we're really trying to do in the big picture is understand how the turtle populations are changing over time and what's driving those changes. And it sounds really simple, but it's actually quite complex to get at those simple things. So to understand what the turtle populations are doing and to understand what's driving those changes. So it's a combination of just natural sort of demographic effects and population dynamics to climate, to fisheries, and to, all sorts of other things that we're looking at.
Let's back up there for a second. I'm very interested in this climate topic that you bring up. So you mentioned turtle populations in terms of climate change, or how climate change will affect the sea turtle populations. How do you look at that?
Well, I think the first thing, it's just a huge topic. I mean, climate change is the scientific and perhaps social issue of our time. And it's such a large geopolitical and ecological issue. It's sometimes hard to bring it down to specific things. It can kind of seem overwhelming to understand it. So what we try to do is, in order to understand how climate change is going to affect these populations in the next 100 years, we're trying to meticulously document how climate affects these populations throughout the records that we have. So what that means is we try to understand how various things like the temperature of the oceans affects the sex ratio of the populations, because turtles do not have sex chromosomes. Their gender, their sex, is determined by the temperature at the incubation period at the beach where the nest is. And if that changes over time, then the sex ratio of the population could change over time. But we also try to understand things like basking, which is something that's kind of unique here in Hawaii with green turtles that actually come out on the land. A lot of people in Hawaii come to see turtles, and the green turtles just haul right out on the beach. Well, that we believe is affected by climate as well. But then also other things that are perhaps not as obvious, and this is, you know, sea turtles, they don't, unlike mammals or birds, they don't really have any active parenting whatsoever. So with a seabird, for example, like an albatross, you'll have the parents may mate for life, and they will parent, they will feed that chick for an extended period of time. They will protect it. And if it's like an orca, you know, like a killer whale, there will be, you know, the mother will give the calf milk, and they'll swim around and they'll protect it. And so there'll be apprenticing as well, teaching it what it means to be a whale. With turtles, what I like to say is the climate is really the parent. If these little hatchlings, they go out into the open ocean, and the productivity, how much food is there, is really dependent upon the circulation. And these circulation in the ocean, in the deep ocean, can have this characteristic behavior over time. Some years it can be very productive, and other years it cannot be very productive. So the ocean and its climate is kind of like a parent to these hatchling sea turtles, and this can have a very profound influence, we found, over long time scales. So if the ocean can, for extended periods of time, maybe 20 to 30 years, be in a mode or a regime where it's relatively unproductive, that can really affect the turtle populations in that time. Conversely, you could have a period of very high productivity in the ocean, and that could really influence the recruitment of new individuals to that population. So we're trying to understand how climate affects turtles in the data that we have, so we can predict in the decades and centuries to come how it's going to influence through climate change.
That's amazing. I had no idea about the ocean temperatures influencing gender ratio. And so what do the genders look like right now? That you, what is the information telling you for current trends?
Well, that's a great question. In Hawaii, we have two main sea turtle populations, the green sea turtle, which everyone knows about. And this turtle nests largely in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, remote coral atolls that are relatively unaffected by, you know, human activities, especially directly. We find in the green sea turtle population over time, there's almost an exactly 50-50 sex ratio, and which it's almost uncannily equal. Now, what's interesting about the green turtle population here in Hawaii is that people think about, you know, we had these recent hurricanes and it got national and international attention, but because they're rare, and one of the reasons they're rare in Hawaii is because the water isn't actually as warm around Hawaii as people think it might be. It's Hawaii, it's tropical, you know, pineapples and palm trees, but the water's not as warm as it is in Florida, where there's a lot more hurricanes. Well, this actually is relevant for the sex ratio of the green turtle population. Up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, it's actually one of the coolest green turtle nesting beaches in the world. And so as climate change warms oceans, this population of green turtles may actually be set up better than some of the other populations around the world, like in Florida, where the waters are already warmer. Now, the hawksbill population is much smaller and was historically exploited for different reasons, for the shell on its back, not the meat of the actual turtle. And it was basically like a semi-precious, you know, jewel, like a stone, and it was an international commodity. This population today is very small, maybe 100 adults in the entire population, and it does not nest in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands anymore. We believe historically that it might have, but right now, today, it nests on the east and southern portions of the Big Island in the Kau in the Puna district of the Big Island, where the hurricane just hit, and these beaches are further south. They tend to be black sand beaches, and they are much warmer. This population is not 50-50 males and females. We believe it may be as high as 87% females. So warmer ocean, warmer beaches, warmer nesting temperatures means more female bias in the population. So we actually think that we're somewhere between 85 and 90% female in the hawksbill population, and this is actually a pretty significant concern.
And so I have to ask, going outside of the climate realm a little bit and shifting to fisheries, what are the greatest concerns that you have surrounding the turtle populations and the fisheries with the growing population of the green sea turtle in the main Hawaiian Islands?
Well, you know, the one thing about the turtle populations that we have here in the main Hawaiian Islands, the hawksbill and the green turtles that I just mentioned, is we actually have relatively few interactions with our offshore fishing fleet, our longline fishing fleet, that are, you know, sometimes hundreds of kilometers from Hawaii. We have many more interactions with recreational sustenance fishermen from the shore. And my colleague Irene Kelly is going to come on later, can tell you about a cool program that they're doing to work with fishermen when they accidentally entangle. They don't want to catch turtles, they want to catch fish. And so they have a cool program with that. With green turtles and with hawksbills that are in Hawaii, I'm not very concerned. I don't really have much data that would give us much cause for concern about fisheries interactions with those turtles. We're more concerned just about the population size and buffering against future anticipated climate changes and really having a diverse portfolio of nesting grounds to sort of think about it that way. Right now, both of those populations, kind of metaphorically, literally, the eggs are kind of all in one basket. And with green turtles, it's in the French Frigate Shoals. With hawksbills, it's on the Big Island. And we have some concerns with both of those nesting areas and long-term conservation with climate change and sea level rise and nest temperatures, as I just mentioned.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for taking some time to share that information. I learned a lot from that short conversation, so I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us. I want to move a little bit away from the science now and talk a little bit about some of the conservation on the North Shore. Mm-hmm. With us here in the studio is Jim Kennedy, who is the treasurer and board member for the North Shore-based nonprofit Malamana Honu. Jim is a retired financial services career person for about 10 years and has now immersed himself into turtles. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Carly.
T- tell us, for those of us who have not heard about Malama Nahonu, can you tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yes, it was first organized, pulled together as a group in, 2005, and it was called Show Turtles Aloha. It was pulled together by George Balazs with Noah and also Joanne Pettigrew, who happened to be a neighbor to the Laniakea Beach, who saw all these turtles starting to come ashore and thought together, they thought it might be helpful to have some volunteers to be there to keep excited visitors at a respectful viewing distance and at the same time educate them. So it started off as Show Turtles Aloha, and in 2007, it became Malama Nahonu as a Hawaii nonprofit corporation.
So now Kyle was talking about the uniqueness of the green sea turtles and how they like to bask here in the main Hawaiian islands. How do you monitor these basking turtles that come up to the shore, North Shore, and all the people that come to see them?
Okay, one of the things we do, and we do this for NOAA, who's one of our great financial supporters, is we log in every turtle that arrives, out, pulls itself out of the water, and when it returns to the water, we try to identify it as accurately as we can. And we actually have nicknames for all of them. To help that process that our volunteers gets involved in, what we do is we try to get high-quality close-up photographs of their scale pattern on their heads. Or markings that may be unique to one turtle versus another, like a nick in the shell or something. So we accumulate this data on a daily basis, day-to-day basis, and we turn that over to NOAA once or twice a month. That data is something that they can go into their data bank and they can use for whatever purpose they want, help track which turtles are still around and what have you. When we started this group, when Joanne started the group 10 years ago, we were seeing about a half a dozen turtles. Today we have over 24 different turtles that regularly come to the beach. Our role there has been, as much as anything, to protect them from the over-enthusiasm that every beachgoer has. We do that by placing a red perimeter rope about 6 feet around the turtle, not on the ocean side because it'll wash away, but about 6 foot perimeter. And then we engage the visitors about the turtle, their past plight, their coming back, respectful viewing distances, some stories about the different turtles and the personalities of some of the turtles there.
So are the visitors, for the most part, respectful of the program?
Oh, yes. By far, they're all respectful. Residents alone, just really top of the line in terms of enthusiasm, showing their friend visitors about them and the need to keep a good distance. And then people from other countries, from around the world. I've been volunteering 8 years there on the beach. That's the most fun part. And I probably have met people from 100 different countries. And to a person, I've never really met a real ugly beach goer.
That's wonderful to hear. Do you get other types of turtles besides the green sea turtles?
You know, I have not seen any other kinds of turtles on our beach. I know that they mentioned earlier, a few minutes ago, about the presence of the hawksbill. I think I know enough to recognize one of those, and in 8 years I have not seen one.
And can you recognize individual green sea turtles? I know you said you take some notes and photos of the markings. Can you personally recognize certain turtles?
Yeah, that's the most fun, challenging part of the whole volunteer experience. We do keep that ID book at the beach, and it's waterproof, so it'll not be ruined and can be used by our volunteers. But yes, we've made it fairly easy for our volunteers, and myself included, to identify the individual turtles. We first look at them and say, is it a male or a female? Well, the tail tells the tale, as they say. You know, long tail, it's a male. Then we look at other exterior markings. And some of them, a half a dozen of them, I could identify just like that. The rest of them, just to be sure that I'm giving right data to NOAA, I pull out that ID book and double-check the scale pattern. It is as unique to each turtle as our thumbprints are to ourselves.
Amazing. And Why Laniakea? What's so special about that beach that the turtles come and nest there?
That's one of the most frequent questions we are asked. We do not know for certain, but we have some reasons we suspect contribute to that. For one thing, there is a natural lava rock jetty that protrudes out into the ocean. And it actually breaks up much of the wave action from the North Shore swells from the North Pacific. And it kind of acts as a protective cove. A honu that crawls out there may crawl 15 or 20 feet. But if it crawls out further on the shelf where the beach isn't protected from the wave break, they may have to crawl 30 or 40 feet. And the other reason is that it has a species of limu, the seaweed. That's what the term we used in identifying seaweed here in Hawaii. A species of limu that is thought to be one of their favorites. You know, they find this, it's their favorite restaurant to come back to. So you take the combination, and we think those are pretty reliable, pretty good reasons that they keep coming back to see us.
Sounds like a very fun and worthy endeavor. Are you guys looking for new volunteers, or what's on the horizon for Malama Nahona?
Thank you for that opportunity. We're always looking for new opportunities to outreach for new volunteers. We have a swelling and shrinking of volunteer membership. It's been as high as 100 plus. It's normally around 70. We have a hardcore group of about 35 or 40. That are there almost every month. But we get turnover, teachers moving to different universities, military spouses and family members being transferred, and just the turnover that happens with volunteer groups. So we're always looking for individuals who would like to help us out at the beach. I can tell you, having been on the beach doing Wednesdays, most Wednesdays for the last 8 years, there is not a more enjoyable volunteer experience you could possibly have. You're on the beach, it's sunny, everybody comes and says, "My God, look at these wonderful turtles." It's a great experience. So we would welcome any of your listeners to contact us, and we'd be glad to talk to them about being volunteers.
And where do they go to find out more information?
Okay, the first thing they do is they go to malamanahonu.org. That's MALAMANAHONU.org. And once you're in our site, there's a section that says, "How can you help?" And you can donate or volunteer. If you check mark volunteer, donating is okay too, but if you check mark volunteer, we will get back to you. We try to have a training session at least once a month. And the individuals will then, they'll be contacted, they'll be scheduled for our training orientation, which lasts about an hour to 2 hours. And after that, then they shadow some of us, more experienced volunteers, a couple, two or three-hour sessions, and then they get their wings, and they are able to start doing volunteering.
Fantastic. Well, Jim, thank you so much for taking some time to share about Malama Nahona with us. It sounds like a fantastic organization and definitely a worthwhile cause. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Irene Kelly and have a little bit more turtle fun. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors: D.R. Horton Schuler Homes, University of Hawaii Federal Credit Union, R&R Solar Supply, and Hank's Tax Service.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
In town, got an accident on South King Street between Pi'ikoi and Ke'eamoku. On the drive west, there was an accident on the H1 at the H3 exit. Traffic's backed up to the airport exit. Wanalua traffic slows before Middle Street. Inbound traffic from the west is slow from the Likelike to the Punahou exit. Further east, it slows at Cocohead Avenue. To Kaneohe, the lights are out in the Wilson Tunnel. Use caution.
You want to get solar for all the right reasons, to live greener and get your utility bills under control. But the one thing you don't want is to get stuck with a solar conversion system that can't keep up with changing electrical rules and regulations. So get a system that's future perfect, one smart enough to let you use all the renewable energy you can produce, plus store the surplus for when you want to use it. That's Outback Power, with exclusive grid hybrid technology backed by legendary support. With an Outback Power system, you can have it all. Net metering when it's available, or off-grid independence when it makes the most sense. Contact Outback Power Technologies for an installation specialist near you.
Aloha.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha, this is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. Do you want free 5 panels? How about a free trip to Vegas? I know, free financing. Then don't call me. For 25 years, Kamiyama Solar believes in treating our clients with respect. We do not subcontract. We do not offer anything for free, besides Aloha. What we do offer is hands-on installation with 25 years of experience and a 10-year workmanship warranty. Call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200. Aloha at 554-7200. Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis. You know, I'm offering you folks a chance to get an education, this time about on-bill financing. You've heard about the new bill the governor signed, paying for your photovoltaic system on your electricity bill. As you may know, the governor just signed this revolutionary bill, and it is directed and aimed at folks that have no ability to find the upfront money for their photovoltaic purchase. If you have questions, you can always call me or attend my seminar. Get a hold of me at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. And aloha.
Hi, I'm Frank Rogers from Leakmaster Roofing and the Cool Roof Store. We sell and install protective roof coatings for all types of roofs. What kind of roof do you have? For flat roofs, we recommend silicone roof coatings because they withstand unlimited ponding water and they come with a 50-year material warranty. We feature trusted names like Geico, NXT Cool Zone, and Apoc Silicone with some of the lowest prices in town. If you have a Monier roof or a metal roof, we recommend that you recoat them with NXT Cool Zone to make them shine like new. Asphalt shingles can be protected and waterproof for the lifetime of your home with the Cool Roof Store's ceramic coating. Whether you want Leakmaster Roofing to install the coating or want to do it yourself, come on down to our store in Kaka'ako or visit us at leakmaster.com. Why re-roof when you can simply recoat?
So you're doing the right thing. You're getting a solar voltaic system for your home or business. But did you know the crucial decision is which microinverter to choose? A microinverter is what's going to convert the sunshine from your solar panels into electricity you can use.
But not all microinverters are created equal.
The Enexis microinverter system dramatically boosts energy harvest with higher wattage microinverters. We're talking up to 40% over its competitors. Year after year, you'll be getting more bang for your buck.
Because not all microinverters are created equal.
So make sure your contractor offers the Enexis microinverter with the system you can monitor yourself. Your system will shine today and be ready for a brilliant tomorrow. For more information, visit enexis.com. That's enexis.com. E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com. That's E-N-E-C-S-Y-S.com.
My name is Brayden Navas, and I believe in education. I say get one. Take it, solar guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, the Marine Science Gal. Last but not least, we have Irene Kelly here with us today. Irene is a conservation biologist and currently holds the title of sea turtle specialist, I guess. I'm sorry, I missed my notes there. What's your official title?
Hi, Carly. It's Sea Turtle Recovery Coordinator.
That's the one. Yeah, there we go.
Fancy title.
Thank you very much. So thank you for being here, Irene. Can you tell us a little bit about the program that you've been running and how successful it's been?
Sure, yeah. One of the programs I'd like to talk to you guys about today is our Fishing Around Sea Turtles program. But just to back up a little bit, I work in the management side of the house. We spoke to the researchers, and I'm on the management side of NOAA. And when we talk about management, what we're talking about is the management of humans and people around turtles, right? We're not managing turtles, but we're managing people and behavior around turtles. So as Jim mentioned, you know, Malama Nahonu at the beach, managing human interactions and closeness, how close people can get to turtles. Mm-hmm. So one of our programs is working with fishermen. Given that our population is increasing and interactions have increased over time as well, we know this because of the sea turtle stranding program. The number of stranded turtles due to interactions has increased. And so we are trying to find a way to address this problem without, you know, vilifying the fishermen, because they're just trying to fish. They're not out to catch turtles. They're not doing anything wrong. So how can we empower them with the tools and the information that they can use to help promote and contribute to conservation while at the same time minimizing any impacts they might have to the population. So we start off by convening a steering committee because, you know, I'm just one person and I don't speak for all people. And so convening a steering committee was really key to this. So we've got partnerships with the state and with DoeCare and with NOAA Enforcement, Fish and Wildlife, you know, a number of stakeholders on our committee. And we came together with a message that it's okay to help. So if an accidental interaction occurs, and it's safe for both you and the turtle, we ask that it's okay to help if you can reel in that animal and get as much line off the animal as possible. It's not the hook that's as much of an issue, but the line that can strangle them, tangle, get around their flippers and their head and get them caught to the reef. And so by partnering with fishermen and by partnering with Barbara Circle Hook Program as well, we're able to carry that message along and to try to get this out to the fishermen.
That's a really important message because oftentimes I hear people say, you know, NOAA doesn't want you interacting with protected species at all, but that is good to know that you are encouraging folks to help when they can.
Right. Well, we don't encourage interacting, but if the interaction has occurred, you know, right, we want to help encourage to minimize that interaction, right? So it's called a mitigation. So you're mitigating the impact of that interaction. And what we found, too, is that the fishermen were already doing this, right? Some of the Pono fishermen were totally doing this. And so now by talking with them, we understand that, you know, they're feeling empowered, that it's okay, that we're on board with what they were already doing. So what we've realized is that it's not just working and working with fishermen, but it's also educating the community, because here the fisherman is trying to do the right thing. He's reeling in the turtle to get the line off the animal, and then you have the community behind him yelling at him to let the turtle go, and he's trying to do the right thing. And so really it's about educating everyone, the entire community, both fishermen and non-fishermen alike, so that we all know that we're all on the same page when it comes to, you know, fishing.
It's really nice to hear a successful program like that and NOAA working with the community. How have the fishermen responded?
I think they've responded really, really well and really positively. I think it's opened a level of communication that we didn't have for a while. Like I said, we partnered with the Barbara Circle Hook Program, and that program is also doing really great work and working well with fishermen. And in all the fishing tournaments, there's a Barbara Circle Hook component, and people are active, you know, using Barbara's hooks, and that's good also to help alleviate any injury. You know, if you interact with a turtle by accident, you can become you know, you can lose the hook easy. So, you know, so there's all these different strategies that you can use both, you know, while fishing and before fishing.
And so let's step back for a second here. The Barbless Circle Hook Program. Can you tell us, for those of us that aren't familiar with that, a little bit about what that is?
Okay, well, I think, well, Kurt Kawamoto is the best person to speak about barbless circle hooks, but I will do my best. So a fisherman can do if they want to fish barbless is simply crimp the barb of their hook so that it can be released more easily. Now, that helps for catch and release. If you catch a fish that's unwanted, you can more easily release that fish. Or if you inadvertently catch a monk seal or a turtle while you're fishing, that hook comes out far more easily, and it doesn't need, you know, intervention to clip the hook. So it just slides right off. So we're looking at it as a management type of activity that you can do to help promote conservation, catch and release. So it's really a sustainable way to fish. And fishermen are proving that you can catch fish on barbless. Like all of the tournaments, some of the biggest tournaments are coming in, the winners are coming in on barbless. So, you know, fishermen are proving that it's working. Fishermen are enjoying the challenge as well. Many times, you know, they see this as a challenge. And yeah, so it's all a win-win for everyone.
That's excellent. And now I want to talk a little bit about the sea turtle population, because I have don't feel like we got enough into that earlier with Kyle. And because the population we know is increasing, how is that reflected in the protection laws? What are the existing laws, and what's in line for the future?
Right. Well, as we all know, the population is protected by both the Endangered Species Act and under state law. They're still protected. Nothing has changed today. And so I do know that many people are probably aware that we've had a petition to delist. And I'll say that the agencies, both NOAA Fisheries and Fish and Wildlife, we manage the population as a team. And so the agencies are looking, undertaking a global status review right now. It's a green turtle status review. The results of that status review, I believe, will be out shortly, with probably within a few months, I would guess. But we've been saying that for a while, too. So cross fingers that that will come out, and it'll give us a little bit more definitive information on what is the status of the population, where are we at, where do we need to go. Kyle really alluded to some important and significant threats that still are looming there with regards to climate and sea level rise. And so it'll be interesting for me as well to see where we take management of this population into the future.
These things take time.
They do take time.
I look forward to seeing the results of that. Now, besides the barbless circle hooks and working with the fishermen, what else do you do to help protect the turtle population?
Well, my focus, honestly, is where are we seeing the biggest impact and the biggest threats? And so the stranding program really helps to advise that. And so that's why we focus so much on the fishing. We work with the boating community as well, with Dobor, post a watch as well, because we know if a boat strike turtle tends to be a dead turtle. So we're looking at where turtles are facing their biggest threats. We also have, the human disturbance situation around the state. Statewide, we've got basking turtles everywhere, not just at Laniakea now. They've discovered Ali'i Beach. They've discovered all sorts of other beaches on other islands. And the tourist industry is also picking up on that as well. And so we've got a lot of user conflicts on these beaches. And so the issue is not as much about what is – when it comes to disturbance, is it about the turtle? But it tends to come down to the community level about respect and protection, from that community perspective. People don't like, to see people too close to their honu. They like to see some distance. They like to see that, and that's what we try to preserve and hope to impart the message of enjoying turtles from a distance. They're there, enjoy them, appreciate them, but give them the space because they're wild animals.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned to me in the commercial break that there is a number people can call if there is a stranded turtle or if they come across an injured turtle.
Right. So the stranding program is really very important to us because it shows us where threats might be and what the issues might be with turtles. If anyone comes across an animal that needs help, that appears stranded, sick, injured, perhaps dead, you can call NOAA's stranding number, and that number here on Oahu is 725-5730. Just put that in your cell phone, because when you're at the beach, you're going to need that number. And I'll say it again, it's 725-5730. And if you see an animal in need of assistance, call that number. On the weekends, there's a pager number, but call this number and it'll give you that pager number, and somebody will come out and take care of that animal.
That's great. Do you guys get a lot of stranding calls? Do you get a lot of involvement from the community with this opportunity? Or
we get a couple hundred turtles stranded a year. Yeah. Oh, wow. So statewide, right? So most of the activity is on Oahu because that's where more people are, but there are turtles that come up, 10, 20 turtles a month, a couple hundred a year.
And you guys do a lot of outreach about your program as well. I know you're going to be at the Fishing and Dive Expo this weekend. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
At the Blaisdell. I just found out about this week myself. I don't have too much to say other than that we'll be there. The Barbless Circle Hook Program will be there, and we'll be partnering with them. And so if people want to come out, fishermen want to come out and meet us there and talk story, we'll have hooks that we can share with them and give out, and information and messages and anything that, they want to talk about, we're there to answer questions.
Fantastic. And I just wanted to wrap up, too, because I sort of didn't get a chance to ask Jim about the Malamana Honu program. You were mentioning your involvement with Hawaii Tourism Authority.
Yes, I mentioned that NOAA has been a big supporter and actually one of the starters of our organization. But another really important one, is the Hawaii Tourism Authority. They have been so supportive from the get-go since we started our incorporation and became a non-profit tax-exempt organization. So thank you very much, Hawaii Tourism Authority and NOAA.
That's fantastic. I know NOAA's been a really strong supporter of several community programs, and want to thank you, Irene, for coming onto the show today, and Jim, to you, for talking about this important issue. And I hoped that there are no phone calls regarding strandings for the sea turtles, but I'm glad that there are programs in place to help if need be. So what's that number one more time if people need it?
Okay, that number again is 725-5730. And there are different numbers on different islands as well. And so if you're on Kauai or Maui or the Big Island, check NOAA's website and look up stranding program and you can get those numbers.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Irene. I'd like to thank all my guests today for chatting with me about the special Hawaiian green sea turtle. I want to give a special thanks to Jeff Davis, the solar guy, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and Kosi Island Earth. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.